The Midrash Rabbah explains to us that when Hashem decided to create Adam Rishon, first he went to the Malachim, he went to the celestial beings, the angels, and he asked permission, so to speak. The tremendous humility of Hashem, he wanted to demonstrate for the rest of creation what humility means. So he asked permission, should we create Nasa Adam, should we create man? The Malachim said, Matibo, what is the nature of this man that you wish to create? Says Hashem to these Malachim, Chachmoso Meruba Mishalachem, his wisdom is greater than your wisdom. And in fact, then, after creating Adam, Hashem proved to the Malachim that the wisdom of man was greater. How did he do that? He brought each animal in front of the Malachim, and he asked them to name them. But naming them didn't mean just give them a name by convention. In our world, we look at a table and we say, it's a table. By convention, by convenience, a board with four legs under it is called a table as a method of calling it. It's a label. What Hashem asked the Malachim to do was to define the essence of this animal, define its nature, define its inclination, define the very essence of the animal. And the Marzu explains, when the Mefarshim on the Midrash Rabbah explains, that Hashem was asking him to define everything about the animal and then give it one clear label. The Malachim were not able to do that. And then Hashem brought each of the animals in front of Adam, and Adam said, Zu Sus, Zu Chamor, Zu Gamal. He gave them names, but the names define the very essence, the nature, the inclinations of the animal. He was able to perceive. He had such wisdom and understanding that he was able to look at the animal and perceive its very nature and define it in one fell swoop with one defining word. And when the Malachim saw that, they were awed by his wisdom. And then, after going through all of the animals, each one, Adam noticed that it had a mate. The cows each had a mate. The giraffes each had a pair. Each of the animals in creation had a mate, at which point Adam says to himself, I don't have a pair. And then Adam says to Hashem, why is it that I was created alone? Why don't I have a pair? At which point Hashem says, I will create an Ezek Kenegdo, I will create a mate for you. And that's when Hashem created Chava for Adam. But the Medrash explains to us that this was all part of the plan. Explains the Medrash that Hashem did not want to create Chava before Adam asked. And explains the Medrash why. Because Hashem wanted Adam to ask for it. Because if he would ask for it, he wouldn't be kafei tov. He would recognize it. He would appreciate it. If Hashem would just provide a Chava, a mate for Adam, Adam wouldn't appreciate how special she was, how magnificently she was created. But if Adam asks for it, he says, I need one as well, he'll appreciate it, and therefore he'll come to a different sense about it. And therefore Hashem waited until he asked. Only after Adam asked did Hashem create for him Chava. And that's a Medrash. And if you think about this Medrash, it's very difficult to understand. Why? Because clearly this Medrash is telling us that Adam HaRishon was brilliant. Yitzir Kapov Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the handcraft of Hashem. The height of creation. Wisdom that surpasses any other creation. Obviously, with such wisdom, he would look at the mate that Hashem created for him, recognize how perfectly formed she was for him, and obviously he would appreciate her. Why does Hashem have to go through this whole, excuse my expression, this whole charade? Let Adam go through all of the animals. Once he sees all the animals have a mate, he doesn't, then he'll ask. He'll ask, he'll appreciate it. If we're dealing with a brilliant, understanding man who recognizes anyway that everything that Hashem does is for the best, what does he need to ask for? Oh, if he asks, he won't deny it's good. But if he doesn't ask, it's not going to work. It sounds rather almost immature. It sounds like we're dealing with a teenager. If he asks, he'll appreciate it. But if he doesn't ask for it, he won't. It sounds very difficult to understand. And to understand this, I think we need to better understand a little bit of the mechanics and the basics of marriage. The Rambam defines for us exactly what makes a perfect marriage. The Rambam says that there's an obligation upon the man and there's an obligation upon the woman. If each of them meets their obligations, there'll be shalom bayis, it'll be beautiful, it'll be wonderful. If they don't, well, then it's a very different situation. And then the Rambam clearly defines for us what exactly it is that the husband is obligated to his wife and what exactly it is that the wife is obligated towards a husband. Explains the Rambam, Chiyuvu Chazal. Chazal made an obligation. Chazal obligated a husband to respect his wife more than himself and to love her as he does himself. Mechabdo Yosemigufo. It's a Gemara. A man is obligated to honor, to respect his wife more than himself and to love his wife as he does himself. So too Chazal obligated the woman. She's obligated to look at her husband with tremendous respect, to act with him as if he's a tsar, as if he's almost a king, to almost be in awe, to treat him with excess, covered, yoser midai, tremendous respect. And these are the obligations that the Chazal put on the husband and on the wife. The husband's obligated to honor his wife more than himself, love his wife as himself. The wife is obligated to treat her husband with kavod yosemidai, with extreme amounts of honor. And of course, if a husband were to act that way to his wife, and a wife were to act that way to the husband, obviously we would not have any shalom bayis issues. There wouldn't be any marriage discussions, everyone would be happily married and everything would be wonderful. And interestingly enough, most of the time, the chasan and kala do just that. You look at them during the sheva brachas. You look at them during engagement. When he walks in the room, you could see her head turn and she's, wow. You would think, who knows who walked in? When she speaks, he listens with such a careful ear. He treats her with such kavod, with such regard. She treats him with such regard. They're obviously treating each other with respect and love. And it seems to be obvious that marriage is going to be perfect. And then something happens. What happens is real life settles in. Real life settles in, and all of a sudden, not everything she says is so pleasing in my eyes. Not everything he does is so pleasing in my eyes, and before you know it, there's a lot of lack of respect, there are a lot of words, there are a lot of issues, a lot of things going on that don't quite fit the Rambam's formula. And here's the point. If a person wants to have a successful marriage, they have to work on their marriage. And they have to recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us tools. Hashem gave us very powerful tools to accomplish a perfect, beautiful marriage. But you have to use the tools, and you have to work at them. Some of the tools are easy to use. Some of the tools are not so simple to use. The first tool is almost magical. It's something called infatuation. He looks at her, she looks at him, and whoo, the magic. They've done studies that show that a young couple in love, if you do the brain studies, you look at the chemistry, the brain chemistry, the effect on the neurotransmitters of a young man in love are similar to cocaine use. They're very real, very significant changes in his brain chemistry. There's a happiness, there's a euphoria, there's a joy. And you'll hear guys do strange things. They dance on the rooftop. They're, oh, my color is perfect and wonderful. That sense of magic passes. Some couples have it to a large extent. Some couples have it to very little extent. Some couples don't have it at all. That force called infatuation is something that Hashem gave as a tool, a very useful tool, and it's a magic that feels like it'll last forever, but always passes. It's always the sense, wow, oh, and it passes. And ironically, when I think about speaking to Chasanim about Shalom Bayis issues, I realize that I'm talking to the wall. because no matter how much I tell them that there's going to be issues and problems and things that you don't like and things you're going to have to change, they look at me with a glassy-eyed look, maybe other people, but for us, it's different. I'm so in love with her. She's so in love with me. All I want to do is make her happy. If she wants me to change, I'll just, of course I'll change. She'll want me to dress differently? Of course I'll dress differently. She'll want me to do something, it'll be easy. Why? Because I'll want to do it. And there's that sense of magic, that sense of infatuation, that it's going to be great, it's going to be wonderful, and that sense of infatuation wears off. Use it as a tool. It is a very good catalyst to begin the relationship. Instinctively, intuitively, the chassan acts appropriately to the kala and the kala to the chassan. You fulfill the Rambam's words exactly. You respect your kala, you love her, and the opposite is true. The kala looks with tremendous regard at her husband, and it's a tool, that magic, that infatuation is a tool to be used to begin the marriage, but it is guaranteed 100% to wear off. Use it as a beginning. More you have it, fine. Less you have it, it doesn't really matter. It's not the only tool, but it's a wise person who uses that tool properly. And that's the first tool that a couple need to help build their marriage. Again, some couples don't have it at all. It's not the end of the world, but if you have it and it's useful, use it. It's a very important tool. The second tool that Hashem gave us is imperative and vital. That second tool is the romance, the sense of attraction of man to woman, woman to man. One of the most powerful forces in this world is that sense of attraction, and developing that romantic sense is imperative, is vital to a marriage. If a marriage it doesn't have within it a very real connection, very real attachment, if there isn't love in the marriage is doomed to fail. There is no way that you could take two people from such different backgrounds, different temperaments, different upbringings, ask them to live in the closest proximities, and ask them to remain even marginally friendly unless there's a powerful bond of love, and that must be worked on. It's not enough for just to be there. It's not instinctive and natural. It's something that must be worked on. We've discussed this in other shmuzim. The way to work on it isn't that difficult. You have to be a romantic partner. What that means is at least once a week as a couple you go out. You make sure that you're polite and you're kind. You make sure that you're sensitive. You make sure that you send notes, cards, love notes, different things that lets your spouse know that you care. And you make sure that you keep the sparkle. You make sure you keep that fun. You keep that romantic sense going, and it doesn't matter if you're married for 2 weeks, 2 years, 20 years, or 40 years. You have to keep that romantic sense going. As a couple, you go out and you enjoy your time together. At least once a week you go out and you don't discuss the kids or the problems or the bills or whatever issues that are normally troubling you. You go out and you date just like you dated back when you were chassan and kala, just like you dated back then. And it's also a very wise idea to take vacations. Vacations don't have to be exotic trips to Italy, to Switzerland. Vacations can be specifically time that husband and wife spend together, paying attention to each other, working on the relationship, enjoying each other's company, just having a good time. And it's a wise idea to take those vacations often. Probably most effective is every 3 months to take a mini vacation. You go for 2 days, 2 nights, whatever you can work out babysitter-wise and etc. You don't have to go to a fancy place, but you have to go away. For sure, once a year, much more preferably every 3 months, you take a mini vacation. You spend a few days, at least a day and a half, something where as a couple you break away from the busyness, from the tirdus, from everything that's going on, and you spend time as a couple, and you rekindle that romantic love, and that is an imperative part to a marriage. The odds of a marriage succeeding without this piece are very slim. And unfortunately, we tend to get sloppy in this area. listen, I've been married already 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to date. If you're not regularly going out as a couple, if you're not regularly working on the relationship, and working on the relationship means in a very intuitive, natural sense. You enjoy each other's company, you have fun together, you find those things that you already enjoy, and you do them together, and as a couple, you bond. And this tool is something that's imperative, and without it, you'll never succeed. There's another tool that, unfortunately, most people are not aware of the significance of, and that is physical intimacy. Hashem designed a certain activity that causes an attachment, that causes a bonding, that causes a husband to love his wife and his wife to love him. Physical intimacy has that effect. It brings them together, causes an attachment. And Hashem created that act to, at least a big part of it, to bring a couple closer together and to create a bond of love. And you have to recognize its importance, recognize its function, understand how it works, and each couple has to be focused on the other in it. This is not the forum to discuss this part in depth, but these tools, infatuation, romantic love, physical intimacy, are imperative for the success of a marriage because they build the bond of love. Interestingly enough, the Stipler Gaon in his Egeres writes that these may be tools, but they're not the end goal. He explains that the end goal is a real attachment, a real love, but not a love in the way that the Western world uses it, not romantic love. The real goal is Reim Ahuvim, friends who love one another, an attachment that's so deep, a bond that's so real. The end goal is not romantic love. The end goal is not infatuation. The end goal is a real attachment as friends who love one another, a perfect connecting. And therefore he explains that the real bond comes from sharing life together. The real attachment comes from sharing goals together, from working together on issues, on things, being together as a unit and going through life together. And then he explains that there's another tool that's very, very important. It doesn't function the way the other ones do, but he also says is imperative for the success of the marriage, and that's something called appreciation. For a husband to say, wow, look what my wife does for me. I'm so appreciative. Not to tell it to her, which alone is very important, but more significantly to feel it and to count to himself all of the things that she does for him and be margish, feel a tremendous sense of appreciation, tremendous sense of, wow, I'm so indebted to you. Look what you do for me. And that will cause the sense of appreciation, bring the sense of love, but not a very shallow passing infatuation or romantic love or anything of the like, a real attachment, bond of friendship of two people working together in life. And the wife has to look at the husband and say, wow, look what he does for me. I'm extremely appreciative. And when each of them use this as a tool, it's a very significant part of building the bond. Now, it's a little humorous because oftentimes I hear husbands say, what does my wife do for me? I had a guy say to me this line, my wife, I mean, she's just there for the ride. I work real hard. I bring in the money. I have to take care of things. She's just basically there for the ride. She's got an easy, she married well. She's got it easy. I asked this fellow one question. Who gets up for the baby? Who changes the baby? Who dresses the baby? Who worries about the laundry and the cleaning and the kids' clothes? And if you have 4 kids or 5 kids, it's a job that the load of which is hard to imagine. What a woman does in the house is indescribable. And if you're not sure that it's true, try it yourself. Try it for a day or a week, and you'll find yourself exhausted physically, mentally, And when you realize what your wife does, she cooks and she cleans and she takes care of everything in the house. She is the house. If you stop and take stock of that, you'll recognize that every time there's a meal cooked, wow, I appreciate what my wife did for me. Every time there's laundry that's done, wow, I appreciate what my wife did for me. Every time there's clean clothes, whether it's dry cleaning, or whether your kids are properly dressed, or whether there are appointments made for the teachers and for dentists and for everything else that goes, the myriad details that go into the running of a family, if a husband stops and takes stock, he'll feel a sense of overwhelming appreciation, tremendous hakarasa tov, and that will bring him along the path to respect and love his wife. And obviously, a wife has to have the same process for her husband. A wife has to stop and say, wow, look what my husband does for me. He's a nice guy, and he helps out with the cleaning, he helps out with the kids, and he earns a living, and he takes care of our needs, and my husband does this and does that. And a wife has to sit down and take stock of all the things that he does, and she has to be eternally grateful. Some women may say, that's true, but my husband doesn't even earn a living, barely helps with the kids, doesn't do anything. What should I feel appreciation for? So first of all, most of the time that's not at all accurate. If you sit down and think about how much he helps, the odds are very good he helps a lot. But naniach, let's even say you're correct. And I have seen such cases, I've dealt with such situations where the husband does not earn a living, does not help in the house, does not help with the kids. He's a freeloader. Whether he should be or shouldn't be is another issue. But what if you're married to that person? What should your attitude be? So listen to what the Stipler says. He says, madam, what would be had you not met him? What would be had you not gotten married? You'd be 45 years old today, and you'd be a single woman. Do you know what it's like to be an older single? Do you know what it's like to be 40 years old, 45, 50 years of age, and single in the Jewish world? You feel like a fifth wheel. You don't feel a part of things. You don't belong. If that man wasn't your husband, that's where you'd be. You're right. Maybe he doesn't earn a living. Maybe he doesn't help with the kids. Maybe he's not doing his obligations. So in that sense, you don't have to have appreciation for that which he doesn't do. But because of him, you're a married woman, you have a family, and you're vastly better off. And if a woman thinks about that, it will bring her to a sense of tremendous appreciation. And I believe that this is the answer to Adam HaRishon. You see, Hashem wanted Adam HaRishon and Chava to have a perfect marriage. But to have a perfect marriage, there have to be a number of features in place. One of them is a sense of appreciation. And as much as Adam would have recognized Chava's greatness, as much as he would have recognized that Hashem designed this woman for him, it wasn't until he asked that he was ready to appreciate it. I need it. Hashem, please help me. Then he was ready to appreciate it. And as the Medrash says, even that wasn't sufficient because the first bump in the road in Isha Shenasasi Madi, he right away was blaming Chava and apparently was showing a lack of Hakaras HaTov. But the reason why Chazal tell us that Adam had to ask for it is because a sense of appreciation is something that's necessary, tremendously vital to a marriage, and without it, it can't succeed. So Hashem wanted Adam to go through the process. And the point is, you could be brilliant, you can define the essence of every animal, but the emotional experience of appreciation is something that requires techniques, something that requires working on, and Hashem wanted Adam to go through the step because only when he goes through this process will he actually feel that sense. Now, here's a certain reality that unfortunately is true. The reality is that we human beings are kafui tov. We do not appreciate that which we have. Probably the biggest illustration is that in the course of history, there's never been the type of wealth, abundance, and luxuries that we have today. In the course of humankind's existence, there's never been so much plenty, so much available freedom, opportunity. And if you ask the average person today, are you rich? Rich? Oh, come on. You barely pay my mortgage, barely pay my kids to rich. And yet if you compare our lifestyle to those living 150 years ago, 200 years ago, there's no comparison. Luxuries, we have electricity, we have air conditioning, we have carpets, we have straight walls, we live in homes. By and large, we have it so much better than ever before. And yet how many of us wake up in the morning and say, wow, Chasdei Hashem, look at my riches, look at my wealth. And we're supposed to. We're supposed to say an entire series of brachas every day before davening, thanking Hashem for the fact that I have mobility, that I can walk, that I have eyes with which to see, I have hands. We're supposed to thank Hashem because we're supposed to recognize all that we have. But unfortunately, the reality is that we don't. And this is something that requires work in general, and specifically in a marriage. Because if you are even doing part one and part two, the infatuation part went well, and you even work on the romantic part of it, and you're using physical intimacy in its proper way, if you don't work on appreciating who your spouse is, there's going to come a point where it will clearly affect your relationship. And the reality is that most of us don't do it, and most of us don't understand even how to do it. So I want to spend a few moments on the process. And to do that, let me share with you an interesting example. What do you do if you have a fellow who's paranoid? The guy's paranoid. How do you help him? Now, here's the problem. And the problem is that you can't tell him he's paranoid because in his mind, he's not paranoid. Look, when I stand next to the cop really reached for his gun. Why did he reach his hand there? And when the postman was walking by, see, was reaching for the letter, didn't you see his hand was right by the mace? Come on, it's obvious. You see, if a fellow's paranoid, he's not going to say, I am paranoid, my fears are unbased. He's going to look at the world with fear. And he's going to define every situation as a frightening situation. He'll experience it that way. And what are you going to tell him? What do you mean, don't be afraid? The cop was out to kill me. Postman was out to spray mace in my face. The car's looking to run me off the road. And the problem that you have is that he feels that the world is out to get him. And this brings us to two very, very important yesods for marriage. And that's, how does one deal with feelings? The first you sowed in terms of dealing with feelings is you cannot deny them. If your wife is bothered by whatever it may be, and you tell her, come on, it's Mishigas, don't do it, you're making a big mistake. If your husband really, really cares about something and it bothers him, and you say, come on, you shouldn't be bothered by that, you're making a big mistake. Why? Because he really feels that way, she really feels that way, and to deny feelings is not fair, not nice, certainly not a friend, certainly not something a friend would do to another friend, and it could be very damaging to your marriage. And therefore, a husband has to learn to be sensitive to the feelings of his wife, and a wife has to learn to be sensitive to the feelings of a husband. Usually there's more work on the guy's side, because women typically have more emotions. Their emotions are more easily aroused. They feel things to a greater extent. And usually their feelings are stronger. And therefore, it's the man typically who has to be more careful in these regards. But it's not exclusive. Women have to work on recognizing that their husbands have real feelings. And even if to me it's not an issue, that doesn't mean to him it's not. So the first rule with dealing with feelings is you can't deny them. But the second rule of dealing with feelings is you cannot be defined by them either. Oftentimes it happens that a woman gets down, whether it be the time of the month, whether it be postpartum, and her sense is the world stinks and my husband stinks. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with women when they say to me, my husband's horrible and terrible and And right away, I understand why she's saying that. She's saying that because she just gave birth 2 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and she's going through a change in her brain chemistry. It's postpartum blues, postpartum depression. It's a part of life. And the difficulty is that she really feels it. She could be brilliant. She could be extremely intuitive. But at that moment, she really feels like her husband doesn't care. Things always work out badly. And the blackness with which she views the world, she feels is real. You can't deny it, but she has to recognize that she can't be limited and can't be defined by those feelings. And the answer to the paranoid guy really is like as follows. Sir, you are 100% feeling what you're feeling. There's no question that you're feeling it. But your job now is not to feel it. Your job is to train yourself to recognize that the feelings that you have aren't based, aren't real, and not to be limited by your feelings. It's correct that you feel them. And I'm not going to deny it, nor will anyone deny it. But your job is to stop those feelings from limiting you, from defining you. And the Sefer HaChinuch explains to us that not only is man capable of doing this, it's a yesod in many, many mitzvahs. The Sefer HaChinuch explains, we have a mitzvah of lo sesaveh, don't desire. And he asks the question, how could it be? How could you tell me not to desire? The guy pulls up in an emerald green Jag. Wow! I wish I could have it. You tell me not to take it. Tell me don't plot. Tell me don't plan. How can you tell me not to desire it? It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I want it. Explains the Sefer Chinuch, ki biyada adam, it is within the hands of man, limno atzmo, to prevent himself, umachshavosav, and his thoughts, v'tavosav, mikol mashi yirtzeh. It is within mankind's capability to change, to stop himself from thinking these thoughts, and stopping himself from desiring them, and it's within his ability to move close or far away from whatever he wishes in these ways. And what the Sefer HaChinuch is telling us is that we are far more malleable than we think we are. You see, normally we say, what could I do? These thoughts just come to me. And that is a mistake. Why? Because if you pay very careful attention, it's an astonishing, complex thing that happens to the human. You ever walking down a street, and guys will appreciate this mushel a little bit more, you're walking down a street, and all of a sudden your eye catches something, and you say to yourself, I don't want to look. But you look anyway. What just happened? I didn't want to look. I looked anyway. Or you're thinking about something, and all of a sudden your mind goes somewhere else. And you're thinking about something else. Wait, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to be jealous. I don't want to be angry. And all of a sudden, it happens. What's happening is that you, the neshama, the one who was put into this body, think through the mind, but the nefesh bahami, the animal soul, also uses the brain. But it tries to kidnap the brain. It tries to take over the brain. And if you have a jealous thought, what happens is that midah called jealousy tries to take over your brain and make it think jealous thoughts. But guess what? You don't have to give in. You don't have to allow it. And you could say, no, I'm in charge. I will not think that. I will not look where I'm not supposed to look. I will not think that what I'm not supposed to think. And you can train your mind to control. I'm in charge over here. I'm in charge of this brain. This brain will think what I want it to think, when I wanted to think, as I wanted to think. Now, the problem is, okay, sounds in theory nice, sounds wonderful, but lamaisa, how do you do it? And I want to share with you a technique that is so simple and so effective that it's frightening. Any issue that you want to work on, whether it be jealousy, whether it be anger, whether it be whatever it may be, if you spend 10 minutes a day thinking the opposite thoughts, speaking out in your mind. Some people may need to speak it out verbally. Many people can just speak it out in your mind. If you speak out the opposite thoughts, what happens is if you do it long enough, long enough, long enough, it begins to effectuate a change. Let me give you an example. Some people, especially in our day and age, it's more common probably than ever before, some people have a low self-esteem. They could be talented, they could be put together, they could be extremely successful, but they look at themselves as garbage and dirt, and nothing I do succeeds, nothing I do is worth anything, I'm a loser. Now clearly that person has a problem with reality, because everyone else views him as highly successful, a tremendous talent, great person, but he has a problem with reality. What is the solution? What he has to do is he has to write down his milas, whatever they may be. I learn well, I organize, whatever his strengths are, he has to write them on a piece of paper. And each day for 10 minutes, he has to review them and say to himself, I do this well and this well and this well, I'm successful, and this was the proof of it, and this was the proof of it, and this was the proof of it. And for 10 minutes, he's going to say it. And the first 8 or 9 minutes that he's saying it, within him is another voice that says, come on, it's not true. You're not put together. You're not, and you have to say to yourself, I am, and quiet down over here. I'm in charge. And if you say these words, and sometimes if it's a real battle, you actually have to speak them out. I'm put together and I'm successful, and whatever I'm involved in, Hashem helps and I do well. And if you say those words for 10 minutes a day, the first 8 or 9 minutes oftentimes is a struggle because there's a voice inside that says it's not true. But if you do that for one day, a second day, a third day, a fourth day, after a while, it becomes more comfortable. After a while, you realize maybe there is some truth to it. Maybe there is something really there. And if you do it for 30 days, there's a very real change in you. It's not going to solve all of your problems, but the next time when you something bad happens, you get a bad mark on a test, your boss ranks you out, you lose a deal, and you're going to feel down, you're able to say to yourself, wait a minute, stop. That doesn't mean I'm a loser. It doesn't mean I'm worthless. This was a setback in life, and I'm a successful person because you did the work. If you did the work for 10 minutes a day for 30 days, within you, you've strengthened yourself, you've come close to conquering yourself, and you're at a point where you and you are in harmony, and you could win the battle. But it has to be done. It has to be done 10 minutes a day. It has to be done as an exercise, and it has to be something that's become a real part of you. And when you do it, whatever your issues are, if it's paranoia, if it's depression, if it's jealousy, whatever it may be, you do this and it works. And that's exactly what the Sefer Chinuch is explaining to us, that you can change the very way you think. And I hate to quote car magnets around here, but the car magnet is well defined, because the way you think becomes the way you feel, becomes who you are forever. That is a reality. Now, with that being said, let me share with you something very, very interesting. Chazal tell us that the woman is the house. One of the Amoraim used to call, would always refer to his wife as Basi, as my house. And the reality is, certainly in our world, the woman takes care of the children and their upbringing, and certainly the house in terms of the furnishings and everything there. Many, many, many times I heard my Rebbe, the Shiva Zatzal, say, stay out of domestics. Guys, don't get involved in it. That's not your affair. It's a woman's place. And the reality is that a woman often defines herself by her house. Certainly if she's married for a long time, she'll define herself by how geschickt she is, how organized, how neat, how everything is put together, how everything just seems to flow. Her kids are always dressed and always on time and there's always food. A woman takes great pride in it. Interestingly, the Stipler tells us that a woman by nature needs her husband's approval. He says in his Igeres that a woman in her world, all that matters to her is to have a husband who loves her, who respects her, and she thrives on that. And these two factors sometimes come into conflict. Watch the following situation. Let's imagine we have a woman who's very neat, and her husband isn't. And one time, she comes home, and the house is a mess. And she's embarrassed. Why is she embarrassed? Because this house is a mess. The house reflects on me, and it speaks badly about me. And she's embarrassed. But more than anything, you know why she's embarrassed? Because her husband is here. And in front of her husband, the one who she craves his approval, wishes for his love and his... and saying, feeling good in front of, in front of him, she has to suffer this embarrassment. So what does she do? She yells and screams at her husband, "Why'd you do this? You're a mess. Why'd you do this?" Do you hear the irony involved here? Because the house defines who she is, she's embarrassed. And especially because it's in front of her husband that she's embarrassed. And he's the cause of that embarrassment. So what does she do? She yells and screams at him. Now, why do I share that with you? I share that with you because the most complex, complicated relationship on the face of the planet is a husband and wife. There is no relationship in humankind's existence that is anywhere near as complex as marriage. It is extremely dependent on many, many factors. And more than anything, one of the most complicating parts of a marriage is the fact that each spouse looks at the other as their spouse. That's my wife. That's my husband. That's my wife, and she reflects upon me. That's my husband, and he reflects upon me. If he's very successful, people approve of him. My husband is well accepted. If this is my wife, and people feel she's wonderful and everything proper and good, it reflects upon me. And because they're a unit, because they're one entity, oftentimes that creates many, many complications in a marriage. And let me explain to you what happens very, very often. Very often you'll have a husband or a wife will say the following. "Listen, I cannot respect my husband. I would like to, I just can't. Yes, he earns a living, and it's true that he, you know, takes care of the kids, but let me say, he doesn't have a dominion. I can't respect him." A husband will say about a wife, "It's true, she's organized and takes care of the kids and does everything she's supposed to, but she weighs 350 pounds. How could I respect her?" And you'll find many, many reasons why a husband or a wife will say, "I would like to, but I cannot respect that person." Sometimes it's because of personal habits. "I can't respect him. He's a slob. I can't respect him. He's not frum enough. I can't respect him because of this or that." And you know the same thing from the guys. "I cannot respect her because..." And every time you hear that, you have to say to yourself, "Uh-huh, I'm beginning to understand why a marriage requires work." You see, if you do not respect your spouse, I guarantee your marriage will suffer dramatically. Why? Because listen to what the Rambam is saying. A man has to respect his wife more than himself, love her as himself, and a woman has to look at her husband, treat him with excess, midai, yose midai, tremendous respect. Well, guess what? If you don't respect your husband, he's going to know it in a heartbeat. And if you don't respect your husband, your marriage is going to be in jeopardy. Why? Because he knows it, and he understands it. And here's a very, very important observation. If you look at the way the Rambam says it, he says, Chazal commanded a husband to respect and love his wife. Chazal commanded a wife to respect her husband. Here's the question. If it's natural, why did Chazal have to command us? You're married, you're going to respect her, she's going to respect you, everything's great. If it's natural, why did Chazal have to command you? And the answer is because it's not natural, it's not a given, and it's something that requires working on. Just like you have to work on the bond of love, you have to use romantic love, you have to use the physical intimacy, you have to use the appreciation. One of the key ingredients to a successful marriage is respect. And you have to work on it just like you would work on anything else. And if in fact you have a ma'akev, a problem, and you say, "I can't respect my husband, I can't respect my wife," because of whatever the reason, you have to get to work. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Let's say a woman says, "I could accept anything but laziness. Laziness, I could, anything. I can't respect him because he's lazy." Okay. Or a guy says again, "I can't respect her because she's avoid. I can't respect her, him because he's not serious in learning. I can't respect her because whatever it may be." So I want to share with you what's really happening here. I once had a father say to me as follows, "I can't believe it. Do you know what my son did? By the way, this father made an appointment, came down to speak to me. Do you know what my son did? No, what do you know? He went. What? Now, at this point, I'm thinking, who knows where he went? He went to a Yankee game. I said, what? He went to a Yankee game. So I said, okay, so? What do you mean, so? He could learn 10 hours a day. It doesn't mean anything. If he goes to a Yankee game, the whole thing is worthless. And the problem was that he was serious. And he really meant it. As far as he was concerned, his 20-year-old son could be learning 10 hours a day, but the whole thing is worthless because he goes to a Yankee game, and that's his problem. Well, I'd like to share with you that the person who has a problem there is not the son, but the father. Because with all due respect, I'm not sure what the great chait of going to a Yankee game is, but if you say, I can't respect my son because he goes to a Yankee game, you have a problem. The problem is you've made a definition of what a human being should be, what your son should do and shouldn't do, and based on your definition, you cannot respect your son. Well, with all due respect, I'd like to share with you, you're not a HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I do believe this fellow goes up in front of the Beis Din Shamala, whether they'll complain about the Yankee game or not, I don't know, but I have to believe his 10 hours of learning, they'll greatly respect the fact that he dominates, the fact that he's a mensch, the fact that he works on his midos. Everything he does all day long is worthless in your eyes because he does this X thing. Sir, you have the problem. Your son doesn't have the problem. You have the problem. And the problem is that you've created an extremely defined position, an extremely well thought out in your mind, understanding of what a human is, and your son isn't it. But I'd like to share with you why these things happen all the time. If the father were looking at someone else's son, oh, he wouldn't have such a problem. You know, it's okay, he learned 10 hours a day and go to the Yankee game. But he sees my son, and it reflects upon me. And it's like I'm going to the Yankee game, and that's not my shita. And that's the problem. The problem isn't the father's understanding of what's valuable and not what the father understands is what's important or not. It's that the father views the son as an extension of him, and it's as if he's going to the Yankee game, and for a person of my whatever, that's not possible, it's not acceptable. And as a father to a son, that's a very unfair and very sad thing to do, and his job is to reframe and revisit the way he looks at his son and understand that his son doesn't reflect upon him. His son is his son. His son has many strengths, many weaknesses. His son has his nishonos, and the father has his. And don't go putting your emotionality, your definitions upon another person. It's not fair. And that exact same thing happens in a marriage over and over. Do you know why the woman cannot respect her husband because he's lazy? Because she views him with her emotionality. And she's not lazy. So what do you mean he slept late? What do you mean he doesn't go to a minyan? I can't excuse that. Why can't you excuse that? Because you're judging him based on your standards. You're looking at him like he's an extension of you. You would never do that. Since you would never do that, you can't accept that he would do it. And what you're doing is unfair. And by the way, I'd like to say, any of these women who have all of these very clear definitions of what a person should do and shouldn't do, I'd like to ask them one simple question. Is the 40 years of age are over, this question for sure will apply. And that question is, madam, are you overweight? A very interesting thing happens to most women when they're 40 and older. Their metabolism changes and they find a great problem with weight loss. And they put on weight and they're very concerned about it. They're very, very bothered by it. Now, why is it that she's able to live with herself? Why doesn't she jump off the roof? The answer is because Nebuchadnezzar, I wish it weren't true. I wish I had an easier time dieting, but Lamaise, it's difficult. Well, madam, with all due respect, your husband has a different emotionality. He's a different person. And you may be right. The weakness that he has may be laziness. But that doesn't make him buttle, doesn't make him worthless, doesn't make him a person who's not worth respecting. You have to stop imposing your definitions upon him. Stop framing him the way you are or the way you want him to be. And sometimes it's almost sad I've had situations where the wife will say, I know that he has X psychological problem, and I can't respect him. Now let's focus on this. If she was a friend to another friend, and a friend was depressed, would she say, I can't respect you? Get out of bed. What's wrong with you? Why are you just staying there in bed? Get out of bed. Just come on, get it together. That's not nice. Person's depressed, it's a problem. Right? There are tools, you have to work, fine. But she wouldn't be so critical. Why is she so critical of her husband? Because she views her husband as an extension of her. She's created an image of what he should be doing, how he should be, and she's not being fair. And it requires reframing, re-understanding. You don't have a right to take your emotionality, your strengths or weaknesses, impose it on someone else. You don't have a right to create your image of how it should be and impose that obligation upon your spouse. And the first job that a spouse has to do when he or she says, I can't respect my spouse because of X, is they have to reframe. And reframe means look at that situation with a different set of eyes, with a different criteria, to understand that the reason why your husband does X is because that's his nature. Does he have to work on it? Yeah. But he's a slob. Why is he a slob? Because that's the way he was built. Why does he always come late to the minyan? If he was machshiv learning, if he was machshiv Torah, he'd be always on time. Well, guess what? There are many people who are tremendously into davening and consider davening a huge enjoyment, and they still come late. Some people by nature are punctual. Some people are late. Does that excuse it? No, he's got to work on it. But you don't have a right to therefore say, I can't respect him. You have to recognize he has an issue. You have to recognize that you don't have the definition of what a human is, and because he has a chasaron, that doesn't wipe out everything else good that he did. And this part, the first part is easy. The second part is really feeling it. And that's where the system comes in. If you want to guarantee that you have a successful marriage, you have to respect your husband, you have to respect your wife. And the only way you're going to do it is by working on it. And working on it means spending 10 minutes a day going through the virtues, the strengths of your husband or your wife, and you lay them out. My husband takes care of the kids, and he's kind, and he's good, and he learns first Seder and second Seder. My husband is responsible. My husband does this. And probably you write them down, and you say them over, either in your mind or speaking them out for 10 minutes a day. And then when that voice inside says, yeah, but look at him. He's 8:30, he's still in bed. You have to say to that voice, stop it. That's not fair. It's not nice. It's not the way friends act to friends. And you have to shut it down. And you have to work on it. Just like you work on appreciating that which your spouse brings to the marriage, you have to work on not being critical, not being judgmental, not creating a frame of reference that postles the person. And you have to work on respecting that person. And this goes for husbands. It goes for wives. My wife is not an extension of me. She doesn't work with the same emotionality. And let's in fact say she's not really put together. She's not geshik. She'll forget the laundry. She'll forget the dry cleaning. She won't do this. I will never forget. I can't excuse it. I understand something. I cannot excuse a woman who doesn't have supper ready on time. I can't excuse it. How could I excuse it that she's late and she doesn't? How could I excuse it? The reason you can't excuse it is because you wouldn't do that. Well, guess what? You're not her. And don't judge her by your standards. You have to judge her as she is. And the only way you're going to do that is by actually using the system. And the system means spending time, 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day, going over the virtues of your wife, what she does for you, how wonderful she is, everything she does on the positive sense. And when a couple does that as an exercise, what happens is they begin appreciating one the other, and they begin respecting one the other. I've heard a wonderful, wonderful technique for shalom bias. If for some reason you're not able to do this, or you find it difficult, and you're having shalom bias problems, you're having fighting and issues or whatever it may be, I heard a chacham, a zaken, an old Talmud chacham give this following advice. Madam, put your hand on the mezuzah and for 10 minutes a day, daven for your husband's success. Daven that he should be successful in learning and davening in business. Daven that his friends should treat him right. Daven. Ask Hashem that he should succeed and everything should go well for him. Husband, having a problem with your wife? Before you end davening, before you take off your tefillin, stand in front of your Creator and for 10 minutes ask Hashem that everything in your wife's life should go well. She had an easy time with the kids, and she shouldn't miss any appointments, and everything should go well. She should have everything going well. And would you like to know why this works? First of all, it works because Hashem listens to tefillahs, and likely your spouse will have a better day and will be in a better mood. But there's an interesting, deep psychological reason. You see, when you ask for a person's good, when you want for them to have everything good in life, you're expressing love. And you're building love. When you're expressing, you turn to your Creator and say, Hashem, please take care of her. She needs help. Please help her with this and with this and with this. You're expressing words of concern, words of love, and you're going to affect your sense towards her. Obviously, Hashem listens, and that's a hugely beneficial factor. But you yourself will change. And what people have to recognize is that a marriage isn't just made in heaven. It's made in heaven, but we have to bring it to fruition, and we have to do the avoda, the difficult work. What Hashem did was he gave the tools to Adam Rishon. Appreciation is a major tool for the success of marriage. And it wasn't until Adam asked, I don't have a mate, that Hashem gave him a mate. Why? Because Hashem wanted him to appreciate her. Even though he was wise, brilliant, and was quite capable of recognizing all of her advantages, virtues, and strengths, there's a difference between just knowing it and emotionally feeling it, and it wasn't enough. And therefore, Hashem had him ask first. And you have to recognize that there are tools that Hashem gave us. Tools are infatuation, romantic love, physical intimacy. You have to use those tools. There has to be a spark of love in your marriage. You have to make sure that you're always spending time together as a couple. You have to make sure that you're doing things in the right way. But you also have to work on the real bond, which comes from appreciation. And you have to spend time. You have to spend time doing an inventory. Look what my wife does for me. I can't believe it. I'm so appreciative. I cannot begin to thank her. I cannot begin to even thank her. And look what my husband does for me. And when you go through the process of actually speaking it out in your mind or speaking it out verbally, what happens is your sense of appreciation changes and you feel differently. And you have to respect your husband and you have to respect your wife. And if you don't, you have to go through the process. You have to go through the steps. You have to actually do the exercises and the works that are needed. And again, it's certainly a wise idea to daven, certainly to daven for Shalom Bayis, and certainly to daven for the success of your spouse. I want to close with one last thought. It was many years ago, and I brought a couple to the Rishiva Zatzal. The Rishiva Zatzal already was an older man. It wasn't that easy to get in, but this couple were newly married and they were heading south. And it was looking pretty gruesome. In any case, I brought them in, and within a very short amount of time, their marriage was changed dramatically. They're now married quite a number of years, happily and successfully, but that meeting changed everything. Now, you may wonder, what is the great secret? What was the Kameya? What was the Ruach HaKodesh that the Rishiva had? What was the secret? I'll tell you what was the secret. The Rishiva brought them in as a couple, and the Rishiva Zatzal listened very carefully, listened to what he said, listened to what she said, and then the Rishiva asked the young man to leave, and then he began asking her some questions. Listened very carefully, listened some more, asked some more, listened some more. Then he sent her out. And then when the young man walked in, the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal said to this young man the following words, you know, she's a very chashuv girl. I'm very impressed. The Rosh Yeshiva asked a question or two back and forth. They discussed this and that. The Rosh Yeshiva said, you know, again, I'm very impressive. Very, very impressive young woman. I'm very, very impressed. And they spoke a little bit more. And then the third time, the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal said the exact same words. And those words changed their marriage. I'll explain to you why. That young man happened to have been a Talmud of the Rishiva Zatzal. And the Rishiva knew that this fellow was a very successful fellow. He was good in learning, popular fellow. And he held to himself, and maybe he held to himself a tad too much. And what the Rishiva Zatzal was listening for was exactly that point. And when he picked up from when they were together, and what he picked up from when he was asking her was the fact that this guy felt that, listen, she's just not on my madrega, not on my level. And recognizing the disastrous effect that would have on a marriage, Shiva told him, I hold of her. She's a very chashuv young woman. When he heard his Rebbe, Gadol Yisrael, holds of it, wow, it changed his impression of her, and it made a dramatic difference. Would you like to know why this story is relevant? When you feel, I can't respect my husband, I can't respect my wife, you have to ask yourself one question. Who read the Shidduch? The one who made the Shidduch is the creator of the heavens and the earth. Before you were born, Hashem said, this is the one that's right for you. This is the one that's perfect for you. And this is the one that together you'll reach perfection, you'll grow, you'll have a beautiful life together. And if it's not quite working out that way, it's time to get to work. But a big part of work is recognizing that it may not be my spouse's problem, it might be mine. But I can't respect him. I can't respect her. Okay. And that may be a big part of your avoda. And a big part of your work is to look at things differently and change your impression, to remember what the Sefer Chinuch says, that we can change dramatically. You have to use many other tools. You have to make sure that you're polite and you're friendly and there's that romantic spark and you're working on the marriage in that sense. But the sense of appreciation and the sense of respect have to be there. And one of the keys is to remember that Hashem is the one who approved this Shidduch. Hashem is the one who made this Shidduch. Hashem is the one who said, this is the perfect one for me. When a person does that, the Mispalel Hashem listens and hopefully have good, solid Shalom Bayis.